the last 3 weeks I've been on the road. I was up at the University of Oregon giving a talk and then coming down the coast and spending time with friends in the Bay Area before coming back home again by way of Yosemite and Bryce Canyon National Park. We drove down Highway 101 in Northern California just about a week before the whole place caught on fire. So it was looking back on it, you know, so the beauty of the landscape in the fall. One of the things that it brought powerfully to mind to me is Amisha, you know, change. When the Buddha died, his followers were lamenting his loss, and Sakya, the ruler of the Devas, came down and reminded him, you know, that all compounded things are impermanent. They arise and they pass away, for that is their nature. For those who remember this truth, it brings the highest joy. So it was, and being a native Californian, having spent a lot of time up there, looking back on it, the place, the Angela Center at Santa Rosa is where we sat all of our retreats before Spirit Rock got built. And I saw a picture of it this afternoon. It's a heap of ashes. It's gone. Right. Been wiped off the face of the earth. The Angela Center in Santa Rosa, it was a retreat center in a Catholic nunnery, and we sat there for the better part of 20 years while we were planning for Spirit Rock and whatnot. And so it was sort of the birthplace of Spirit Rock in terms of our meetings and whatnot. And now it's kaput. Yeah, fire is getting to be an ever more serious threat in Northern California than it used to be. I do it at least to some degree to climate change. So during the course of our journey, and certainly since coming home and looking at these disasters that have been happening, one of the things, a theme that kept coming up for me again and again and again, was this notion of caring as it's taught, as it's practiced in Buddha Dharma. Because I seem to witness a lot of caring going on, you know. When we were in the national parks, for instance, you know, I found that, as I've known since I used to do, you know, contract work for the national parks, the entire organization is dedicated to service, you know. Caring for the environment and caring for the people who come to enjoy it. You know, it's very much oriented toward helping each of us renew and reestablish our relationship with beautiful places in nature. A place where I found caring to exist that you don't normally think of it being is high-speed driving. if you stop and think about it, you know, the only thing that even makes it possible for us to move around on the surface of the earth in motor vehicles is that for the most part, we all play by the rules, you know. We understand that in order to take care of ourselves and our own vehicles, we have to be taking care of the other as well, in terms of how we drive and the decisions we make. And of course, there are always some outliers, and so it becomes very easy to see who behind the wheel is conscious of how important it is to take care of each other in order that we can take care of ourselves. And of course, when caring is absent, the results are stark and they're painful, you know, and they make suffering evident. And since the Buddha was teaching about suffering and the end of suffering, caring turns out to be one of the core principles in Buddha Dharma. You know, if you remember in the Karaniya Metta Sutta, you know, the Buddha says, even as a mother cares for her child, her only child, protecting her child with her life if need be, so too should we cherish all living beings, suffusing the entire world with unobstructed loving kindness. Part of the path in Buddhism is, in fact, learning the art of cherishing ourselves and cherishing the other. In the Buddha's teaching, the two are indistinguishable. Some of us find that it's much easier to care for others that maybe we have some responsibility for, or who are looking to us for some kind of support or nurturance. And we oftentimes find it easier to care for others than to care for ourselves, which of course is a recipe for burnout. And the Buddha talked about that, as well intended as it might be, as a kind of a reverse form of egotism. He said that essentially we can care for others only in the same measure that we have positive regard for ourselves. The Dalai Lama once observed that much of Buddhist practice is about awakening to our own essential goodness, which then makes it possible to better see it than others, and so to draw it forth. Okay. So he was very, and so is the Buddha for that matter. He taught over and over again how important it was to reflect on the merits of your own good deeds. So this is a dimension of the practice of Buddha Dharma that is very much the warp and woof of the process, but doesn't always get sometimes the attention I think maybe it deserves. Ajahn Amaro, who is a gifted senior teacher in the Thai forest monk tradition, Ajahn Chah's tradition, he said one time, the question that he was responding to was one at a meditation retreat when somebody said, is it okay to move during a sit? You know, because the general instruction is to just try to sit peacefully and calmly and, you know, don't wiggle around too much and, you know, just allow the noting of restlessness if it arises, but see if you can just pretty much stay in one place for the hour. And so someone asked him, well, if something really hurts, is it okay to move when I'm sitting, or should I just, you know, grit my teeth and bear it and let that be the teaching? And his response was this. He said, you need to ask yourself the question, what is the kindest thing I can do for myself in this moment? Not always necessarily the easiest thing. What is the kindest thing? So, what is the kindest or most skillful way to deal with that situation? Is it to notice the discomfort or notice the fear that's behind it and see if you can simply note those things without doing anything about them? And about half the time, if you allow the mind to engage in that kind of inquiry, the difficulty or the discomfort or the pain dissipates, goes away, or at least becomes less noticeable. On the other hand, if you have a medial meniscus, it's in the process of giving way, it's probably a pretty good idea to, you know, unfold your legs. So he said, yeah, just attend to that question. What's the kindest thing I can do for myself in this moment? And he said that carries over into other aspects of life as well. You know, you can apply that to something as simple as whether or not to move when you're on a cushion. But going forth in every major life decision that you make, that is a worthy question. And in contemplating the question, the heart inevitably opens to the other as well. In other words, is there some great kindness I can do to myself that's going to wind up hurting a lot of other people? Well, chances are that's not ultimately going to be a very kind thing to do yourself either. But the importance that he placed, you know, and this is from somebody who's been in Rhodes eating one meal a day for, you know, the last 40 years, right? And so he knows the power of discipline. But the way he explained it for the monastics, he said that even though there's sometimes privation and discomfort, he said, absolutely, this is the kindest possible thing we can be doing with our lives. So, worth reflecting on. As I was contemplating this concept and thinking about different aspects of it, that especially since these things have kind of been on my mind a good deal lately, is the role of gender in caring. So it's interesting to know that in our culture in the late 19th century, as we started to have, you know, an emerging middle class, you know, and higher percentage of the population going into white-collar employment of one kind or another, women gradually began to enter the workforce. But the professional opportunities open to them were quite limited. So for the most part, around that time, about the only professions that women could get themselves into were roles like nursing or teaching, you know, teaching grade school for the most part. So these are the roles in our society that innately call forth the caring response, right? So it was considered okay for women to take those positions because they're the caregivers. So we can deal with that, right? We can live with that. And so we did, well into the 20th century, as women continued to find it difficult to find access to the other professions, until gradually it began to dawn on increasing numbers of people, you know, men as well as women in these professions, that they were getting paid peanuts and had no real power in the institutions that they were working in. And so they gradually began to feel highly exploited because of the caring impulse. Their reward for entering a caring profession was low pay and no power. Okay. So in the 1960s, a lot of important organizing began to happen. Nurses unions, American Federation of Teachers, the first real meaningful, powerful teachers union that was prepared to call strikes. And so when the nurses and the teachers started striking, there was a tremendous amount of public shaming that went on. You know, it was like, well, wait a minute. You know, you're supposed to be naturally caring. You know, what's going on here? You know, you're depriving little Johnny of his education, you know, just because you want more money and a little bit of respect. What's that about? So, same exact thing with nurses. In the 19th century, early into the 20th century, the profession of nursing was regulated by the American Medical Association. And they could perform only those tasks and assume only those responsibilities that physicians found appropriate. The nurses began to unionize. They also became an extremely powerful political bloc. And I guess starting in California, maybe New York, Michigan, they convinced legislatures that there was a little bit of conflict of interest at work, having physicians regulating nurses. And so there's an independent, like, state nursing board here in Colorado and California. It's in the Department of Consumer Affairs that the regulation of the profession of nursing happens, simply because while the impetus toward caring is really powerful, all right, and strong, if it becomes a basis for exploitation, then it ceases to, you know, caring becomes almost disrespected, you know, as or undervalued as a way to live one's lives. And this was kind of brought forth academically in the realm of moral psychology. And it's an interesting field. It's one that talks about how notions of right and wrong and ethics develop in the human brain? What is it that causes or that brings forth or reinforces the caring ethic, right? The care for the other, what discourages it? And it turns out that that's, you know, highly gender-related as well. There was a famous Harvard psychologist named Lawrence Kohlberg who did some work based on the work of an earlier psychologist, Jean Piaget, in The Mind of the Child, where he was looking at the development of the human brain and at what stages in that development a child begins to develop some notions of justice, of right and wrong, of how things ought to be, of how one ought to behave, whether it's individually or as a society. And so he had this scenario that he would give to kids that that had to do with whether or not one should break the law to save the life of a loved one. And the kids at different stages of their maturity would talk about the problem in different ways in terms of how one would think about it and whether it's all right or not. He interviewed only boys in his research. And so he got a certain kind of set of responses, usually having to do with notions of law and justice in terms of how things ought to be. One of his most, perhaps his most famous student was a woman named Carol Gilligan. And she picked up where Kohlberg left off. You know, his work was eventually, he gave the test, that same experiment he did with people and cultures all over the world and whatnot, came to find that for whatever reason, children in the West attain somewhat higher levels of moral development than everybody else, right? And he did give the test to girls as well, and found out that, well, they don't seem to have quite as highly attuned a sense of justice. Okay. They're too mushy, they're too soft-covered. And so Carol was having none of that. So she did her own research, focusing mostly on girls at different stages of development, and it wound up taking the form in 1982 of a book called In a Different Voice. And what she did when she was doing her research was she would present the same question to girls. And the scenario is one in which a man's wife is gravely ill and needs a certain kind of medication in order to survive. The pharmacist who invented it won't sell it to him cheaply enough for him to buy it. So the question arises is, should he break into the pharmacy and steal it at night? And so the boys would respond in a way that Carol referred to later on as an ethic of justice. It was about law, and it was about whether you should obey the law. What she found when she started asking girls the same question is that they would respond with a question. And the question was, what kind of society forces someone to make a choice like that? So they were issuing a challenge to the social structure in response. And so her conclusion was that girls are coming at things from a different standpoint altogether. It's not about law and order, it's about caring for each other. And so she came up with this notion of an ethic of care, you know, a different way of thinking altogether about questions of right and wrong, morality. And soon thereafter, as people began to critique her work as well, the problem that arose was one of gender stereotyping. Of thinking as girls and women being naturally caring and men as being less so. Men as being all about power and the rule of law, not being caring in the classic way. So that somehow or another, something having to do with brain function explains a lot of this. And especially the anthropologists really went after that one. And said, you know, I think what we're really talking about here is enculturation. You know, what kind of qualities of mind, what kind of characteristics of personality do we think it's okay for one gender or another to portray? It's all very well and good for women to be in the caring role, but, you know, the California Nurses Association is one kick-ass political organization. They are a rough crowd. They're one of the most effective lobbies in California politics because they just, you know, rejected that characterization. They said, in order for us to do our jobs well, in order for us to give the kind of care we want to in that setting, we need to be better cared for ourselves. And we're going to do what we need to do in order to make sure that that's a possibility. So when men try to, you know, take on the caring role and whatnot, all too often they're looked at as being a little soft, you know, or not as forthright or as aggressive as they normally are in society. When women try to do that, of course, they're quickly branded as, you know, being uppity or being bitchy or some, you know, negative pejorative as to what is and is not appropriate behavior. So one of the things I think is really incumbent on us is to have a kind of a close look at this whole notion of what kinds of qualities of mind should we all feel free to hold and to express and to give voice to. Yeah, please, Adrian.
Oh, well, I was gonna just mention that there are a lot of male nurses, so.
Absolutely.
So.
There absolutely, along in the 1960s when they were first organizing, more and more men were actually being drawn to the profession, just as there were more and more women going into law. When in my law classes in the School of Public Affairs, more than half the students, graduate students now, are women. And about half of all law schools' class makeup now is women as well. So it's a profession that for a long time was either impossible or difficult to get into. Things have changed a lot. Haven't changed that much in business schools. There's a higher percentage of women in those as well, but nonetheless, it really starts to point out that there are really inherent problems in trying to ascribe certain kinds of motivations or behaviors to just on the basis of gender. There are forms of care also that we don't necessarily always recognize as such. I'm thinking primarily right now, because that's what I'm doing some research on right now, is first responders. Firefighters, peace officers, paramedics, you know, folks who put their lives at some degree of risk in order to protect others. The talk that I was giving up at the University of Oregon Law School was about the well-being of wildland firefighters. And the title of my article they're going to publish is called In Dubious Battle. Because they're being sent in to fight fires. And a battalion chief recently told me, he said, you know, I'm tired of sending my firefighters into what he calls these suicide subdivisions, where they build whole housing developments into the wildland urban interface somewhere with one narrow road with no shoulders in and out because the people that live there don't want to have through traffic. So if fire trucks can't get in very well, they can't get out if things take a turn for the worse. And he said it's suicidal for people to live there, and it's suicidal for me to send my firefighters in there. I'm not going to do it anymore. And so they're going to planning commission meetings, and they're going to city council meetings, and they're saying, this is not worth it. You know, it's one thing if they're... Part of the problem, of course, is that when we think about urban firefighters, absolutely they need to put out every fire just as fast as they can, because otherwise the consequences would be horrendous. You know, that's what we expect of them. Wildland firefighting is quite a different matter. If it's a fire in the backcountry, most forest managers would rather let it burn because it's way overdue for a burn, and they just try to protect communities if it's headed toward them. In Northern California, they have this phenomenon every year where the high pressure cell off the California coast weakens, the air gets really hot and dry in the Central Valley, a lot of high pressure, and so you get these offshore winds, 50, 60, 70 mile an hour winds blowing from the Central Valley through the coastal mountains to the ocean, and it's like anything at all that ignites it. It ignites this very dry brush. It's like a blowtorch, it just sets off. You know, these fires sprang up almost without warning, killed a bunch of people. I think there have been about 40 people or so now have been either burned to death or asphyxiated by the fires. They'll probably find more. And we have these firefighters going in there, risking their lives, doing everything they can to help these folks. The wildland firefighters, I came to discover, have approximately the same suicide rate as returning combat veterans, as well as the same rates of chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, domestic abuse, severe depression. And the reason is because, unlike urban firefighters, which may go out on a call a couple, three, four times a week, intensely fight a fire for a short period of time, and then they're back to the station house, wildland firefighters now are on the fire line for up to 3 weeks straight without a break. Okay. And then they have to take 2 days off, during which time, I've had a lot of wildland firefighters in my classes, during which time they get as drunk as possible and stay that way for as long as possible until they have to go back out on the line again. One of my PhD students was a former hotshot crew member in Northern California, and he had to take a week off from school one fall because he had to go attend the funeral of a close friend of his on the hotshot crew and suicided. They're under such relentless pressure for these extended periods of time that it starts to have exactly the same effect as if you were in combat, because you're in continuous states of imminent endangerment. And that really kind of just does something to the blood chemistry after a while. And you have these chronic stresses and anxieties that get baked in that you don't really have any way to get rid of. And so what I'm trying to do with my own work is to draw attention to this fact and say, this is another of the costs of fighting wildfires in the Wui. You know, and the Italian fire chiefs are starting to say there are certain fires that shouldn't be fought because there are certain structures that should never have been built. And that's a debate that's really starting to heat up, as we say right now, in terms of whether or not we should start having second thoughts about where we allow people to build what, if the effect of doing so is going to put at risk the lives of a lot of courageous caregivers who naturally want to do what they can. Same thing holds true for land development in low-lying areas in the Gulf Coast and Southern Atlantic Seaboard. You know, people are moving into places of imminent endangerment, and they expect someone to risk their lives to come help them when the next hurricane comes along. And so thinking about those who risk their lives to care for others with regard to how we make those kinds of decisions is kind of important. Yes, please.
Most of the wildland firefighters are temporary employees with no benefits.
That's right. They have health insurance when they're working a fire, and at the end of the season, they can buy their own if they want, but they get nothing. The other thing that happens, just like combat veterans, is that when you're fighting a fire with your unit, with your team, it's very much like being in combat in that you have each other's backs, you're taking care of each other, you're protecting each other. Everybody's safety is dependent on the behavior of everybody else. You become a really tight-knit group. And then at the end of the season, that group disbands. And so people are left terribly alone, alone with frightening memories to try to get through to the next season. Please.
I'm always amazed how timely every conversation is to something I've been thinking about. But I'm a nurse, and before being a nurse, I was a professional labor organizer for Service Employees International Union.
Okay.
And I felt that one of the tasks that I feel some responsibility for in being a nurse is to try to address the interrelationship between nurses. Nurses are notorious for treating each other like shit. And they're abusive to each other. And I suppose it's because you're being abused in all different directions. There's nothing you can do about it. And so you abuse each other. But the problem with that, yeah, there's that obvious problem, but also that relationship that you can potentially have with somebody who's in your own experience, just like the wildland firefighters, they are dependent on each other. They understand each other. And they're the only ones that understand each other. So it's of extreme importance that those relationships are fluid and supportive. And what I see in my profession is that they're anything but. We know we have that interdependency, but it almost scares us that that's the case. And we don't have a way. It's if you are kind to a fellow nurse, people are suspicious. Are you tough enough to be in this profession? You know, you might not have what it takes. And so it's an act of courage to be kind and to have respectful relationships and to be mindful of needing to do basic things to take care of yourself. So any advice you have to muster up that courage, I need it.
Thank you so much for your comments. A student in one of my classes a few years ago was the director of in-service training for the nursing staff at a local hospital. And she did the research on the very thing you're just talking about, trying to get some sense of what it is that causes these people who are professional caregivers to not care for each other. And she, again, as you mentioned, came up, one among the things that came up for her once more was power dynamics. If they feel like they don't have much say in their own work situation with regard to the relationships with the management of the hospital, then they kind of tend to take it out on each other a little bit. And she is with working, trying hard to think of ways to kind of work around that one. And even though she was part of the management of the hospital, she was of the view that maybe the nurses needed to be a little bit better organized and willing to stand up to management and say, you know, the way we're being treated is not reflective of how you want us to be treating patients. And we all need to have a look at that one together. It is a big deal. My wife is on the nursing faculty at the University of Colorado School of Nursing for a lot of years. She was a preceptor in the midwifery program. And she worked as a nurse before that. And she pointed out the same thing, that it just seemed curious and it seemed sad that was the case. She also felt it, of course, to some extent in nursing school. She didn't feel particularly well treated by some of her faculty, and she kind of resolved not to do that. One of the things that wound up earning her a certain amount of respect was that when there was a child who everyone knew, usually a preemie, an extreme preemie or something, or a child being born with, you know, gross fatal defects, and they were going to die within a few moments or so after having been born, mostly what they do with the child is kind of wrap it up and put it in a warmer and keep it in the corner until somebody came to pick it up. And my wife used to hold them, pick them up and hold them while they died. And that had the effect on the staff that she was working with at the time, say, oh yeah, that's why we're here. So it is possible to model that kind of behavior, but it takes a certain amount of courage if in fact the ethic is working differently. Also, I want to briefly, without going down a particular policy path, point out the role of caring in debates over public policy in the United States. One of the major debates that we're having right now as a country is whether or not we should use the institutions of government to care for each other, particularly in the realm of healthcare. And there are obviously people with divergent views in American society about that. Some who feel that we do have an affirmative moral duty to make sure that everybody we share our lives with in this country has access to some level of affordable and effective medical care. And others who do not feel that way at all, who just have a much more individualistic attitude. Going forward, that, in my view, is at the core of the question. What kind of society do we want to be? What kind of society do we want to live in? What kinds of values do we want our governmental institutions to reflect on our behalf? And then, of course, are we willing to pay for it? But this question of caring as a society is just sort of front and center for us right now. As is the case, for instance. Please.
I just like to add mental health because I've been in mental health for 20 years and I'm deviating, but sitting with people's psyches as well as trauma, as well as suicide, and I've devoted my career probably the last 12 or 20 years to working with at-risk youth, and I'm here to tell you even in school settings, that it's the trenches for counselors and social workers, child protection, social services, calling police. There's been a tsunami, and I started working at Children's Hospital in 2000. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I'd like to see in these conversations, because I think there is a stereotype of the mental health worker, caring, that's what we do, and I really appreciate you, Lloyd, speaking to you, is at the expense of my own well-being, psychically, emotionally, spiritually, but also, I don't know if people know here, but to even do the work, we have to have master's, PhDs, and free internships, and high student loan debt, and so, with very low pay. And so I think I just wanted to speak to that because mental health crisis workers are doing the work of society doesn't really want to address on a large scale.
Exactly. Thank you. Not wanting to recognize fully the human costs of some of the work that we do. I was one of the founding members or a very early member of an organization in the Bay Area in the mid-1970s called the Shanti Project. And it was established by a psychologist named Charlie Garfield and by Ram Dass. And the idea was to provide companionship for people who were dying. Allow them to die a conscious death, to the extent that they wanted to. One of the things that we quickly realized in doing that kind of work was that it became, unless you want to get burned to a crisp, it became really fundamental that we have support amongst ourselves. That if we weren't caring for each other, we couldn't really care for anybody else. And so that's one of the, it seems to be one of the critical aspects of doing the job, and that those jobs ought to be structured in such a way is that there are opportunities for that kind of mutual care to go on at the same time. It's one of the things that I think needs to be better recognized and better acknowledged. Who cares for the caregivers? They're simply expected to do the work. And we're coming to realize that's not really enough. Not really enough. we need to care for them in a much more conscious way, I think, than we have before. Caring for the environment, caring for each other when we see injustice happening, whether it's, you know, environmental injustice or injustices associated with discrimination on the basis of gender identity, ethnic lineage, religion. You know, that's positive suffering that goes on, and it will not be effectively countered unless we are willing to, you know, take some action to do so. And then finally, want to make some note of the dangers, as have been really manifestly pointed out here, the dangers of caregiving, right? The vulnerabilities that it exposes, certainly to those in the caring professions, which sometimes results in growing a kind of a hardened shell, you know, which is maybe one of the reasons that my student found that nurses tend to rub each other up. It's somehow or another, you gotta be tough, you gotta be able to take it, rather than express the truth of your sentience, you know, express the ongoing sense of connection with those you work with each other, okay? So self-care for all of us, I can hardly overstress the importance of that, you know, of our being our own best friend, and of, you know, just like the Dalai Lama said, you know, recognizing our innate goodness and protecting it, you know, just like in the martial arts, of, you know, the defensive martial arts like Tai Chi, you know, where you're just basically warding off harm, you know, figuring out how to do that for ourselves, how to create a place of sanctuary and of refuge within our own hearts and minds, okay? Being with others who share that understanding of life, just like the Sangha, super important, you know, so that we realize that we're not alone in doing that. It feels good to help others, it just does, you know, until you get to the point of burnout. But that sense of connection, you know, finding a channel for expressing your caring nature, it's really important. You know, whether it's with friends, family, loved ones, others perhaps in the profession, the environment, whatever sort of cause you find yourself drawn to, having some kind of channel, some kind of opportunity to be in that caring relationship, it's really useful and important, and if done sort of, you know, at the same time, remembering once more that ultimately it is impossible ultimately to be an effective caregiver for others if you're not exercising that same degree of care for yourself. There's these vows that, you know, we took when I completed my teacher training program. One is the first one is, I vow to be present for suffering and the end of suffering, okay, whether mine or another's. I vow to teach a graduating discourse. This was the instruction of the Buddha. Keep it simple. Go from, you know, the simple to the more complex. Teach with the spirit of compassion. And this goes true for any of us, I think, whether we are in a helping profession or not. There's no such thing as too much metta depending on one's motivation. If it's selfless and open-hearted, you can be a living exemplar of metta. Okay. Problem with that practice of loving kindness is that too many of us tend to do it out of a sense of aversion. or at least there's that element to it, you know. Sally Armstrong, one of the Dharma teachers I know, says, who teaches loving kindness meditation a lot, she said, for some people, it's like they've got a baseball bat with the word meta written on it, and they run around bashing everything with meta that they want to change, you know, whether it's their significant other or their political scene, whatever. Now you do it, you open the heart to connect with others. I vow to be present for suffering, the end of suffering. I vow to teach a graduated discourse. I vow to teach from a place of compassion and care. I vow to speak without disparaging myself and others. I vow to teach from the spirit of generosity while recognizing my limitations. So the spirit of service is one of the things that is, in fact, at the core of Buddha Dharma, you know, of sila, of living with integrity and generosity. As long as we never forget to be no less generous to ourselves than we are anybody else. Let's take just one moment. May we live with ease and know ease and well-being. May we be safe from all inner and outer harm. May we be happy. May we be peaceful. May we be free. Just as a mother protects her child, her only child, with her life, if need be, so too with a boundless heart, may we cherish all living beings, suffusing the entire world with unobstructed loving kindness. May all beings be happy, may all beings be peaceful, and may all beings be free. Good night. Have a good week. We'll see you next week.